You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 210, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. Today I'm joined by author David Wright to discuss his new fantasy novel, My Brother's Keeper, part of Galahad's Doom series. Welcome aboard the show, David.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back. You were actually one of the first guests ever to appear on this show back around, I believe, maybe episode 2 when we talked about
the Dark Tower
series. Dark Tower, yeah. And so it's exciting to me now to have you back on to talk about something that you actually wrote. So that's very cool and very exciting.
Thank you very much. Exciting for me too.
Yeah. This is a very different fantasy novel from the average thing someone would pick up. And so I want to delve really into it. I don't want to give out too many spoilers, at least too early. We can kind of, what we usually do on this show is the first half, maybe we talk about stuff that's non-spoilerish, and then we give kind of a warning that we're going to turn a corner and maybe get into some spoilerish stuff if necessary. Okay. And so, but that's entirely up to you, of course, because you, it's your baby. So we can, we can at least start out with kind of some, you know, some background and generic stuff. Now, I want to ask you some things like your influences and kind of the history of you writing this book, because I know there's lots of interesting stuff to dig into there. But, sure. But before we do any of that, just kind of give a brief explanation to the listeners of what this book is that we're talking about.
Okay. Well, the name of this book is called My Brother's Keeper. It is the first in a trilogy. The series is called Galahad's Doom. So what it is, it's anyone who's familiar with swords and sorcery, medieval fantasy type stuff is going to find a lot very familiar here. It's that type of story, but it's also one with a strong spiritual theme. And I try to weave a fairly complex tapestry of different characters, different agendas. It's not necessarily a case of everybody that's fighting for the good guys is all of the same philosophy. There's disagreements and things like that there. It's a story that I wanted to tell that kind of the genesis of the idea came from
no pun intended.
No pun intended. came from when I was growing up, I was a kid, when I was fifth, sixth grade. I was kind of a typical Dungeons and Dragons nerd. I was playing D&D at the height of the time when it was all the controversy in the media about how evil this game was and what horrible influences it was on kids. And I'm reading these reports, I'm hearing all this in the news, and I'm just looking at like where are they getting this from? Because I was playing the game and I knew what it was really like, and it was nothing like what the reports would make you think. And it was just weird that there's this reputation for how horrible it was. And then, like, when I'm an adult, the Lord of the Rings movies come out, and everybody's praising it for, and some of these same conservative groups are praising it for its strong Christian message and Christian theme. And I didn't see that either. So I didn't see the devil in D&D, and I didn't see Jesus in Lord of the Rings.
That's a great bit. Yeah, that's a great one.
So, I wanted to kind of explore this odd little area of, you know, this kind of school of thought where there's certain, segment of people. I'm conservative myself, but there are people that kind of take a little further than I do, believe it or not, that anything that has magic in it, it can't be good. We got to stay away from it. You know, that can include like Peter Pan or Alice in Wonderland, you know, if you're going to take that too far. And I just felt like there was room in a fantasy story for something that would include magic, but not necessarily be evil. It was kind of a defense of the fantasy genre in one regard, to kind of demonstrate. Maybe this is a leftover childhood issues, or this is me still trying to prove that D&D doesn't have to be evil. But yeah. It does have a strong spiritual theme. It follows the path of a pair of brothers that, when the story opens, they are already separated from each other and on their own paths. You have Galen, who is the older one, who's sort of the main protagonist. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of the favorite son, and everything just has kind of worked out for him his whole life. And he has joined the Royal Army and doesn't have a very glamorous position as the story opens. But then you have the younger brother, Lucas, who is resentful of his brother and feels like he's always had it too easy. And he's always trying to get noticed and get out from under the shadow. And it has resulted, unfortunately, in him making a lot of bad decisions. And he's found himself kind of in a bad place, and he's kind of resentful of his brother for it. That's where the story opens. It goes from there. You see, fate kind of has plans for them. They end up crossing paths several times through the book, although they don't always necessarily know it. So, you know, it's a book that draws on everything from, you know, personally from Lord of the Rings, Chronicles of Narnia, King Arthur, the Holy Grail stories, but also I try to work a lot of my thoughts and ruminations about a lot of issues philosophically, but you know, from in a spiritual realm, not necessarily stating what I believe, but just kind of exploring it, having different characters ask different questions, and kind of leaving it open.
Yeah, it has a lot of movement. There's a lot of movement to this book in terms of, nobody ever stays in one place very long, and the thing that I liked about that is, A, it keeps things interesting because they're always moving to a new place that they kind of have to, both of them, that they kind of have to figure out and get in the good and the bad side of. But also, you get a nice kind of, you know, it's kind of like you say, like moving around on a Dungeons & Dragons map and slowly learning the map. You know, you're slowly entering different areas, and they become lit up. You know, you know that you can look at the map as any good fantasy type book has. It's got a nice map at the beginning, and it's neat because when you first open the book, you see it, and you know nothing about those places. You think, oh, that sounds interesting. I wonder if we're going to go to that place. And as you read it, they go to these places, and you kind of find out what they are, what they're like, who lives there, what's interesting about them, their history. But never in a heavy-handed way. The focus is always on these two characters as they go to those places, and as they learn about them, then we kind of learn about them. So I like that that you know, we kind of are on an exploration trip with those two guys, and since it's two different characters, we kind of get double the exploration because they're usually going to different places on the map at the same kind of parallel back and forth.
Right. The one thing that I've always always has appealed to me about books like this is the map.
Yeah.
There are people that tell you, no, I don't like the map. Always ignore it if the story has to be able to hold up without the help of a map. Yeah. And that's true. I don't disagree with that, but I like the map. I'm always studying the map. It's fun. You know, I'm geeky that way.
You know, so if I were to write a fantasy book, I'd have to do a map because I've got to interject this. You're exactly right. It's neat. And it's one of those things that you go, oh, that's cool. I mean, you know, like in a lot of my books, I put in things that like a lot of modern publishers would say, oh, you don't need a prologue, or you don't need a dramatis personae, or you don't need this, you don't need that. And I'm like, well, yeah, but it's cool.
Exactly.
And the map is the same way. Like you say, you shouldn't have to have it. But it sure is a neat thing to be able to flip back to every now and then just to kind of say, oh, that's where we are now. Oh, cool. I wonder if they're going to go to that place.
Exactly. And one thing in that, when I'm reading a story, you know, set in a completely new world like that, and it just tosses out the name of a river or a forest or a city or a kingdom. I want to orient myself to, okay, how far away are they from, you know, where did that happen? And the map, you know, just instantly helps you with that. But also, kind of one goal of mine with this book, in as far as how I have structured the trilogy, is I consider this first book to be the first act, and I want to be able to introduce everything that's going to be important to the story. I want to get it all introduced here in this first act. I say that there are new characters that come into play later in the series that aren't in this first book, but I wanted to get all the major characters introduced and all the major locations. Every place that we visit here is more than likely, as I say this, I've written more than half of the next book, it's going to be revisited and things are going to be different. And so I want people to go ahead and get kind of familiar with kind of all the major locations. So I tried to cover that base.
Yeah, absolutely. So now, how about kind of, we're going to get into some specifics in the book and we're going to dig around in, because there's obviously two big things I want to talk about. There's like the story itself and kind of, you know, what you have in mind there. And also there's, like you say, the strong spiritual theme. And if there's anything I think that really stands out about this book and makes it different from almost anything else out there of this type, it is that spiritual nature and message. And I have a lot to say about that, and I'm sure that you do too. But as we get toward that, first, I know that there's an interesting story about how this book even came to be. So give my audience and your potential readers a little background on how this even came to exist.
Well, goodness, you'd have to start all the way back to my game playing days when in elementary school. And a friend of mine named Chris, that I haven't spoken to in many years now, but he and I kind of came up with the setting for where this gameplay would take place. Mm-hmm. And that is where we drew the map. And the map and a couple of the cities got placed, although I later renamed them. And we had a group of maybe five or six of us that played the game. Out of this group, three of the characters from back in, you know, I'm talking sixth or seventh grade for me. This is like 82, 83, somewhere back in there. And these three of these characters are play vital roles in this novel, in my series. We can name those later. But so the earliest origins of this story go all the way back to then. In the mid-90s, I was out of college, well into my career, and started spitballing with this guy that I've known for a long time. And we started kind of digging up some of these old ideas and old memories we had. And I ended up pulling out a notebook of old ideas and story notes and things, and kind of started looking back at what we had done as kids. And next thing you know, we were developing a new idea, a new cast of characters. He was, this man's name is Stephen Hickman, and he kind of had the idea of a paladin, of a knight of the church, and had come up with the name Galen. He didn't have a last name or anything, but that was where the character got started. And it's something that just kind of sparked in my head, and this is right around the time the Lord of the Rings movie started coming out, and I started having that, you know, kind of like this odd thought of this disconnect, like I said, between there's no devil in D&D, there's no Jesus in Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. And I had in front of me a character who was well suited for kind of a spiritual aspect to his character. And I remember that I had my map of the world that we had created as kids. And they all started to kind of coalesce. It was kind of a primordial soup at this point. I had a character, I had a map, I had an idea of a theme that I wanted to explore. And it kind of started from there. That was about 1997. And I just started messing with it, and not with any plan of ever realistically writing a book, but just thinking, hey, this will make a great novel one day. But just playing with it, coming up with new characters, coming up with set action pieces. What are some of the conflicts? You know, I wanted to see basically if we have in our real world, there are conservative churches that are like real skittish about anything that has anything approaching anything to do with magic. Mm-hmm. What if that school of thought existed in a world where there really was magic, and magic was real and not just something in a Harry Potter movie?
All right, let me pause you for just a second there to say, that, I think, is one of the most really interesting and compelling arguments. This is a book of arguments. I mean, I don't mean in the sense of people yelling at each other, but I mean in the sense of ideas and counter ideas being thrown out and colliding. Mm-hmm. And that's one of, to me, the most interesting sort of conceptual arguments that you really bring out and that you kind of walk us through a little bit. We don't resolve it, but we get a lot of thoughts back and forth on it multiple times during the story. And that's the idea that all magic is bad versus there could be a good side of the force, not just a dark side of the force kind of a thing going on. And right. And like I say, you don't really spell any, you don't really spoon feed us, but you certainly raise that question. And I think it's very interesting. And I've got more to say about that when we get into the book itself. So now I apologize, but I just really wanted to highlight that. I think that's one of the most interesting things that you did with that story. So, okay.
Now, well, good. I mean, that was kind of the central, that was kind of the germination point, you know, mm-hmm. where the story grew out of. And it's like, what if, so basically in my brainstorming session, before I knew what I was going to be doing, the question I posed to myself was, well, what if Christianity existed in a fantasy world?
Yeah.
And, you know, what, and these Christians are going to be opposed to magic, but magic's real. What if it's a Christian kingdom? The king says he's Christian, but his chief advisor is a wizard. You know, what are people going to think about that?
Yeah.
And so how's the church organized in this world? And what's the relationship between the church and the throne? And where are the conflicts? Where are the frictions? Who's going to get along with whom? Where are the disagreements going to come from? And I just felt like there was enough grist there to come up with a story. So I ended up, that's kind of where it kind of grew out of. And I would just brainstorm, you know, in my spare time, or I'm eating lunch by myself one day at work, I just sit there and I just start thinking about my story. And I just kind of had developed this pretty finished idea in my head before I ever really thought I would write a novel. And then, and I at this point, it's like, you know, from 97 to about 2003 or 4 is when all this took place. Now, I met you in 1998, mm-hmm. and lo and behold, funny thing happens. You start writing novels and publishing novels, mm-hmm. and I my mind was blown. The fact that a novel could be published. I read your first book, The Wind Strikes the Warlord, from the Citadel series. Mm-hmm. It was awesome. Of course, it has spawned you've got a whole series going. I don't know, what are you on, number 8 or 9 now?
Working on number 8, yeah.
And it was very cool to see a friend get a novel published, but it was also very cool just to hold it in my hands and go, wow, this is a real book. This is an actual real book that can sit on your shelf and has your name on the spine.
And paid my property taxes the first year.
Wow. See, that's nice.
It's nice until you realize that you took all your money you made selling your first novel and paid your property taxes with it. Then it kind of sucks, but yeah.
but that really was the inciting incident. That was the catalyst that kind of galvanized me, made me realize I can take all this ideas and thoughts I have that this kind of this world I'm living in, populated by these characters that nobody else has a clue about. It all is just kind of in my head as like, I have an outlet now. I can do this. And if Van won't publish it, somebody will, you know, cause just knowing that with today's, you know, indie press, the advances and changes in technology, oh, yeah. in Absolutely. Terms of distribution and all that kind of stuff. It kind of opened my eyes to, you know, this can happen. If I go through the trouble of writing it, there is a way to get it out there and let people know about it and read it. So that excited me. And that's when I began writing. That was in, well, I decided I would write somewhere around 2006. But I didn't feel like I was prepared to jump right into a novel. Mm-hmm. So a couple of things happened. I started writing some short stories, mm-hmm. and you published a couple of them. They both appear in the Sentinel's Alternate Visions. But you know, they were nothing like this book.
Right.
They were kind of frivolous. They were funny, or they tried to be funny.
Oh, they were very funny. They were very good.
You know, they're kind of written in a very casual, you know, tossed off kind of manner and tone, which is what I was going for. I also was pleased with how the short story came out in the Gideon Kane anthology from Airship 27, that you were the editor on that. I thought that was a change, a different tone from what I had shown with the Sentinel stuff.
And that's when I really realized, dang, David Wright can write. I mean, I deal with, as a person who's both a publisher and editor, as well as a writer, I constantly try to make my own writing better, but I also deal with a lot of differing styles from other people, that stuff that I get. And, you know, I pretty well know the big guns in the new pulp industry. I pretty well know, you know, what a Jim Beard or a Ron Fortier or a Barry Reese or Bobby Nash or Sean Taylor. I know what their stuff's going to be like. But you were just kind of starting out, and I thought, well, this is going to suck. This is going to be kind of, you know, this is going to be amateurish, but we'll see what we can whip him into shape. And I got your story. I'm like, dang, this is like he's been doing it for years. Your first really serious kind of, you know, sword and sorcery story. And it was just as good, at least, as any of the others. Except for mine, of course, which was much better. I'm just kidding. I thought all of them in that book were very even in terms of being really good. And that's why I had such confidence that when I knew that you'd put so much work into this novel for so long, I had no doubt it was going to be good. And even still, reading it, it surprised me that it was even better than I expected. And I expected it to be very good. It's very aggravating to me how good of a writer you are. So, okay. All right, continue.
I would say my most earnest attempt, my most serious attempt.
Sure.
The Gideon Kane thing, I was very pleased with how it turned out. Mm-hmm. When people find out I'm a writer and they want to read something of mine, I point them to that story because not everybody's a superhero fan, but I figure Gideon Kane, you know, might have a broader appeal.
Sure.
And by the way, you know, I'm still a huge fan of that character, and I'm real excited about the idea of more Gideon Kane stories in the future. But
there is news coming up in 2015 on Gideon Kane, but I can't say anything yet.
Oh, okay. Well, that sounds
movement happening with it, so we'll have a few announcement in a few months, probably a couple of months, probably.
Yeah, I was when I found out about the project, I went out and got a Solomon Kane anthology, read a couple, and then kind of hooked into the vibe of the character, and you know, I was pleased with how it turned out. But this I still, you know, I wrote those kind of in warm up, like, okay, I've got to write my book now. Like, I didn't want to mess it up because this is a story that I've been living with since, you can say 97, you can say 82. I mean, it's I've been kind of immersed in this, but it just felt like I was on the edge of a cliff. Like it was kind of like stage fright getting started. So what I did is I actually wrote, I don't think you know this, as a warm up for myself, I wrote a short story. It turned out to be a little bit longer than your normal short story, about 15,000 or 16,000 words, and it was kind of a prequel to what you have read in my novel.
Mm-hmm.
And it focuses on the character Jabbok, which we can get into in a minute, and it shows what happens to him before chapter one in the novel. And it ends with overlapping action. Like you're seeing the same action from chapter one of the novel, but you're seeing it from Jabbok's perspective and not Galen's.
Right.
And I had to make sure later that all the lines of dialogue matched up, but everything else that's internal is different because it's written from a different perspective. And I did that to kind of find my sea legs a little bit. And
that's always a good thing to do. I always tell people that tell me they don't know how to start writing something they want to write, I say write something smaller with the same characters and get to know the characters. Because once you know the characters better, it's a lot easier. And I would argue you need to know your characters well before you even start writing a book. Or else they're going to be changing while you're writing them and they won't be consistent.
That's true. I won't touch on that in just a second, but I'll say that what that writing that did for me was help me find my rhythm as far as how I introduce a scene, how to keep it coherent, tie it together, how it leads into the next one. I kind of figured out my rhythm from just doing that. And so to give you the end of a very long answer, November of 2007, I started writing my book, and the first draft took a little over a year, to about 14 months. And so that's the story of how that came around.
Mm-hmm.
To get on what you were saying about getting to know your characters first, one thing I do is I will do a little improv piece focused on a character. And sometimes I write it in first person. Sometimes it's just bullet points of like a backstory. But I will sit there and just improv on a character. You know, I start with the role of what role they're going to play in the story, but I kind of figure out what makes them unique, what has shaped their personality, what's happened in their own history to put them at this point in this time.
Right.
And I will just kind of do a little little freestyle, and I have a 1 or 2 page document for each of the major characters that I've done that with. And it helps me, you know, at some point in the middle of it, something will click and it kind of hooked me into that character. And I'm like, okay, that's it. That's this guy. That's what's going to make him distinctive. And so that's what I did. That was my exercise. And hopefully it paid off in the sense that you've got some distinct personalities in the novel.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. There's no question. I mean, in fact, that leads me to kind of my next quick point I wanted to get into with you is that I think that one of the most interesting things about the book is that you have a number of characters that are very multidimensional. And that's not a very easy thing to do, particularly for somebody who's first starting out really writing something this, you know, of a good size length. I mean, that's a challenge. And it's interesting too, because not only are your characters multidimensional and they have, but they have internal, more than a couple of them have kind of internal, struggles going on. Certainly your main two, that's what they're all about, is their internal struggle, dealing with their conflicting, you know, emotions and their conflicting desires and goals. But you have characters. I mean, let me put it this way: when I wrote the first Sentinels book, it surprised me that characters, a couple of characters I thought were really cool, people were saying, "Oh, that person's really annoying." And so I wanted to get your reaction to this. You have several characters, and I don't mean this in a bad way. I mean this in an interesting way. You have multiple characters that just annoy me, but they're interesting. It's not like they're off-puttingly annoying. Although honestly, at least one of them I really wanted to argue with, if not punch in the face.
Which one's that?
Oh, I can't think of his name. Is it Elias?
Oh, Elias.
Elias.
Yeah,
the knight that's trying to like put
mentor Galen.
Galen, yeah. Onto the straight and narrow, and he's just so. I mean, I know let's put it this way, and I don't want to give away too much too early here, but every time he became insufferable, you'd have him dial it back and be nice. But he would take it right up to the edge of me wanting to jump into the book and just punch him. Okay. I'm like, dude, leave the man alone, okay? Stop trying to tell him what to do. Stop trying to you know, make him like you. Mike, yeah. I mean, so I was just wondering, what was your perspective on that? Was he supposed to be that annoying, and did you find him annoying? And did you intend for him to be annoying? Because, my gosh.
Well, I don't know if I would say I consciously set out to make him annoying, mm-hmm. but what I did do was set out to make him him a strong voice for this is a
make
this
him annoy Galen, basically.
Yeah, he's a knight of the church. Galen is not associated with the church. He's merely a regular soldier in the king's army, mm-hmm. but through various circumstances has found himself placed under the tutelage of this knight. And what I wanted for Galen to experience is to encounter several characters that would influence him, either a little angel on the shoulder or a little devil on the shoulder.
Right.
And Elias was going to be one of the strongest voices to try to kind of press him. You know, you always got somebody who's just comes on a little too strong,
mm-hmm.
and is you know, puts a little too much of a hard sell on things. And I wanted, that was the role I set out for Elias. And I wanted, though, to show that Galen wasn't going to necessarily fall right in line with that. And
right.
they weren't necessarily going to be best buddies. And Galen is not someone who, really, Galen, where he starts and the kind of his journey in this book, reflects myself. The questions that Galen has, the doubts that Galen has,
mm-hmm.
they reflect my own thoughts.
And a lot of people, sure.
Yeah, and so I felt like I could get, I I could get into his head really well in that way. Mm-hmm. And I wanted there to be, you know, people with coming at him with different philosophies and ideas. You've got Sir Elias, and you also have the Elven ambassador character Aquilus, mm-hmm. who are both trying to be positive influences on him. Then you're hearing different opinions from people like, it won't mean anything to someone who hasn't read the book, but you have Orion and Ariana. They're also coming at it from different angles.
Right.
And Galen's listening to all of them.
Yeah.
And he's kind of trying to figure out where the truth is. And so did I try to make him annoying? No. But if you find him annoying, I'm not surprised. Galen found him annoying.
That was my point. Yeah. He annoys Galen, but in a good way, because it makes him it keeps churning up these thoughts, and that's what drives the book, really. I mean, there's external conflict, there's internal conflict. This is a book that's pretty much 50-50, would you say, divided internal, external conflict. And the stuff that Elias keeps bringing up is a big motor driving that internal 50%.
Yep, exactly.
Okay.
You're right. It's the engine there that kind of forces Galen to consider some things, you know.
Well, because there's no doubt that if Elias was not in the story, Galen would have already made certain choices, probably irrevocably.
Yes,
that exactly. would be different than what Elias wants him to make.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes, that's true.
And I still want to punch Elias in the face, but that's a good thing, because see, if it stirs up your emotions and draws you in that way, that's a tribute to you. Okay. And I don't want the listeners to think I'm saying that's a bad thing.
Right. I mean, hopefully it's a recognizable personality type.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, even though, you know, you've never been a knight assigned in a castle fighting off monsters in a forest.
As far as you know.
You recognize these people just by their types, you know, and how they come across.
Well, here's the other thing about that before I leave that point, which I think is a really important one to kind of hammer on, is that in addition to him being sort of this voice in Galen's ear trying to lead him along a particular direction, I think that it's also very important to make something clear here. Like you said, this book has very strong spiritual themes to it. There's no doubt about that. Again, I think that's the main selling point. That's the most appealing thing about it. If readers like that kind of thing, and there are going to be people that turns off, you understand,
sure.
But there's also going to be a lot of people that this is like the best book ever, because it goes so strongly there, you know, it's going to be one or the other, you know. And I think it's really important to point out that even when a character like Elias is making these strong arguments, you, the author, David, you never just tell the audience this character's right. There's still question within the universe of the story whether he's right or other characters are right. And I love that about it, because if you at any point on it, I'll be honest, if you at any point had basically in the book said to the reader, well, this one is the one with the real answer and those others are wrong, now let's see if Galen comes around to the right decision, I'd have been very annoyed. But you never do that. And I was so impressed that you never tell the audience who to believe. Instead, you.
Well, thank you.
In other words, I think I know who you're rooting for, but you never.
Hello, you there?
Hello? Yeah. We having a
technical issue?
Oh, dear. I'm here. Well, I'll finish my thought here. You never tell the audience who to root for as far as the points of view and the supporting characters.
Sure. And that was very intentional. Again, it's kind of a translation of, my own, experience, you know, I would say as far as spiritual questions and philosophy goes, kind of translating that to this setting. And so the kind of the voices and the ideas and the influences were, you know, all things that I've encountered, or and not necessarily like one for one, where it's a person I've met who has had these influences. Sometimes it's all, you know, it's maybe I have created a character out of a certain internal voice I have. Like I got one part of me saying, well, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. It could be this way. Well, that becomes a character who's talking to Galen.
Mm-hmm.
Then I have another part of me in my head that's saying, well, you know, people say this and they're probably right. And that becomes a character representing that point of view. So I wanted to give voice to these different things. And really, I'm not looking to give the answer. Yeah. I'm exploring the theme.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to do. Is I didn't want, if all you want is a story about knights and swords and, mm-hmm. and combat, you're going to get that. There's plenty of action in it. It plays well at that level. But if I'm going to take on a novel, I want there to be some sort of theme that I'm exploring, some kind of, if not commentary, then just questions mm-hmm. about the human condition. And I think spirituality is a large part of that. And so, and I've gone into this already of how I even came upon trying to explore this ground. So I just wanted to explore the theme. It was all about exploration. It wasn't about kind of just spoon-feeding an answer.
Yeah, I think that there's enough ambiguity about who's right and who's wrong, and because Galen is never really sure and keeps changing his mind and mm-hmm. and has conflicted, I mean, that makes it very appealing. And I want to mention one other character while we're talking about this. There's another character, I guess the sorceress or whatever, that he kind of likes. And
Ariana.
And all I'll say about her is, to make this point, is in another story, that character would be clearly black and white, either good or evil, and it would be telegraphed to the reader, we should root for them or not.
Right.
In your story, I have no idea if I'm supposed to love her or hate her, and that's very good because it leaves her as a real character and not a cartoon.
Right, and she is a sorceress. She uses magic, and so this is not... an example of this is not a case of where I am giving my own thoughts as
yeah.
far as, you know, is magic good or bad in fiction. You're going to have, you know, magic wielders in this story that are fighting or seem to be fighting for the good
side. Yeah. That was my favorite part of the whole book, I think, was her ambiguity because
I think, go ahead. I was going to say, you can say the same thing about Glamis. He's clearly opposed to the bad guys, but he's also clearly not a religious person.
Right. So if, as the reader, if you come down on the side of Elias and say, oh, all magic is evil, then we should hate her because she's clearly like in league with the devil.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you think he's full of crap, like I did, then she's pretty cool, and I kind of like her, and wish that the main character would run off with her. So, but the fact is, you never hit the reader over the head one way or the other with that, and that's wonderful.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I was obviously going for subtlety and also going for just texture and kind of a rich tapestry. I feel like we have kind of a large cast
mm-hmm.
of characters, and they're kind of all over the map, literally, you know, in different places. Hopefully I've made the characters distinctive enough and accessible enough that you're never lost. You're never confused about what's going on.
You know, let's kind of our last couple of things here. We don't have a whole lot of time tonight, but we'll get in a few more minutes. We've touched on a lot of the things I wanted to touch on, but I wanted to point out there's a couple of things that this book made me think of, and I'm gonna bet that you're not aware of either one or don't know a lot about either one, maybe. But I may be completely wrong. Maybe I'm selling you short. Though there's no necessarily any reason you would. One is that the fantasy aspect of it reminded me in some ways of the Warhammer fantasy universe. Now, that may just be a reflection of what I've read, because I've read Tolkien, I've read C.S. Lewis, I've read Shannara, I've read some Warhammer fantasy. I've read it's fantasy's not my favorite thing. Medieval kind of, you know, fantasy is not my favorite thing.
Uh-huh.
But that's what it reminded me of, because it's hard to kind of put into words. I don't want to spend too much time on it. I don't know if you've ever read anything like that, and if you have any reaction to that.
I have not. The closest I've come to reading Warhammer 40,000.
Well, I'm talking about Warhammer Fantasy.
As
recent guest Josh Reynolds, who writes for Warhammer Fantasy, said, it's like I forgot how he put it. Something like it's like Lord of the Rings during the bubonic plague or something like that.
Okay.
It's a little more grounded in reality than highfalutin like Tolkien, you know.
Well, yes, that's I guess what maybe what you're getting at is, yes, this is a fantasy story, and yes, magic has a part in it, but it's not high fantasy. I would say that like the magic level is low in the story. It's still a very recognizable world as far as all that goes.
I mean, like the elves in it, honestly, might as well just be like Chinese people or or Iranians or something. You know what I mean? In other words, or South Africans. They're foreign more than they're alien. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. Well, and we'll see a little bit more of the elves, and we'll get to see their kind of their home base in the next book.
I kind of was suspecting we'd learn more. Okay, the other thing that it reminded me of, and this is going to sound strange, but then again, I am a professor who teaches religion, is it reminded me of the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita, in this way, and you'll know exactly what I mean when I describe it. And the Bhagavad Gita, very briefly, is one of the early Hindu texts where a warrior begins to question his actions, and he basically sits down with his driver, the guy that drives the chariot while he kills people, and he's like, you know, am I really doing the right thing? I'm having these moral questions. What should I do? And this other warrior, the charioteer, instructs him on religion and his religious duty and why being a soldier is a good thing versus a bad thing and why he's doing his duty and all that. And that's kind of, you know, it's not exactly the same thing, but you see what I'm saying? That's kind of what flashed in my mind.
Well, that's, you know, I think that speaks maybe to the universality of the theme here. I think I'm you know, kind of on a broad canvas. You know, one thing I wanted, I definitely, where I wanted to place Galen in terms of a moral dilemma was to put him in a position where he would have to choose between church and state. He would feel certain obligations to his king, and he would also at the same time feel certain obligations to his church, to his religion, and those two obligations wouldn't necessarily overlap. He'd have to make a hard choice. And in hand in hand with that is, you know, am I doing the right thing? Is this what I need to be doing? Right. How important is this really, kind of thing?
Yeah. So, again, I think the internal conflict is at least as important as external. I mean, you have to have external conflicts. You have a war brewing, and there's sort of monsters, troll like creatures and all that, which are really cool. There's all the kind of stuff that anybody would enjoy that just likes, you know, fantasy adventure. But that internal conflict that kind of runs parallel to it, I think, is what really makes this thing stand out and really jumps out.
Well, I know we're running short on time, but I want to get into Lucas a little bit.
Sure.
The story's not all about Galen. It's a story of two brothers, and Lucas surprised me with how fully developed he ended up becoming. It was one of those wonderful things that just happened during the writing process. My original plans for him picked him up a lot later in the timeline, where in the middle of the book somewhere he basically gets recruited.
This is the other brother, in case we didn't.
This is the other brother, right? Yeah. That scene, that recruitment scene, was chapter one in my first. First thoughts.
Yeah.
And I kept backing up where we picked up with Lucas, where his starting point was.
Yeah.
Took him all the way back, and none of that was really planned. And on those years of development, I never really thought about that. And as I'm writing the opening chapters, only then do I realize, hey, you know, this is lining up where they can actually have a confrontation right here, that first confrontation in the book.
That was surprising that it happened that fast, but it was cool.
Yeah, and so when that happened, I realized there's, you know, it was one of those pleasant surprises that really fires you up.
Mm-hmm.
And what I ended up with was a character that I think is very sympathetic. I didn't necessarily set out to make Lucas very sympathetic. I knew what I was going to do with Galen, but Lucas surprised me, and I'm really pleased with how he turned out.
Oh yeah.
And I think the choices he makes throughout the book make sense for him. I think he's very internally consistent, and things never go well for him. It was fun to write him because, you know, you write a scene with any other character and it would end one way, but with Lucas, it's going to end with somebody punching him in the gut or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's just never going to go right for him.
And just so you know, since you're the writer, you're probably too close to it. I've been in that situation many times. He is just as sympathetic, if not more in a lot of cases, as Galen, because he is down on his luck and things happen to him bad and you feel bad for him. And maybe he doesn't always react the right way, but you still can see a real human being that would react with anger or jealousy or whatever. That doesn't make him a bad character. It makes him a human. And right. So I was rooting for him even while I was watching him make bad choices and get in with a bad crowd and everything. I was still saying, oh, come on, man, you can turn it around, you know. So I hope in the next two books, he doesn't become too one-dimensional, because it's that conflict, that's that conflict even within him that's just as interesting. In some occasions even more interesting than Galen's, because Galen kind of has things bounce his way, and it's always more interesting to see what happens to somebody that's inherently kind of a good person when things bounce there against them.
Yeah, Galen's conflict is mainly spiritual or philosophical. And right. Lucas's conflict is physical,
yeah.
And emotional. He's worried about physical survival, and,
right?
And it becomes the stakes are higher as far as that goes for
yeah.
him.
Yeah.
So
yeah, sort of jealousy and maybe irrational jealousy in some cases, but with a young man, I mean, you know, he's younger than Galen, right? So you can totally see somebody reacting that way. He's a rebellious teen, and he just sort of loses track of the big picture sometimes because of his immediate short-term, you know, feelings, I think. And that's a very understandable character. All right, so, well, we're kind of up against it on time. I'm really glad that you were able to come on and talk some about this book. Any last thing you want to point out about it, and then we'll tell people how to find it.
Well, I'm very pleased with how it turned out. There's a lot of characters we didn't have time to get into that were just a lot of fun to write. And I think if you enjoy medieval fantasy, you're going to enjoy this. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if it is a strong spiritual theme, mm-hmm. that's what you're going to get with this. Like you say, nothing is spoon fed. There's no stance that's spoon fed. It's just kind of an honest exploration of this character. One high concept of this mm-hmm. that I didn't touch on, I'll touch on it real quick.
Sure.
A lot of times in epic fantasy or heroic fantasy or superhero comics or whatever, what's at stake is the end of the world, and you're fighting for the end of the world. What I realized, if you know much about the Bible, there's two great disasters. You have Armageddon that takes place in the book of Revelation, the Battle of Armageddon. Mm-hmm. That's basically the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But that's been done a million times in stories I've read. But there's another one. It's in the book of Genesis. It's the great flood. It mm-hmm. destroys the world. But what it really does is kind of wipe the slate clean so you can start over.
Right.
And so that's what's at stake in this series. It's not the end of the world, but you're up against the clock because the world might be about to restart.
Right.
And
yeah.
So that was a twist on that I wanted to go with, because I felt like the end of the world Armageddon stuff, you know, has already been done too much. So that's one thing, and you're going to see that go forward in the rest of the series. One thing that's kind of time bomb ticking in the background throughout this first book is the threat of war and the build up of the forces. Mm-hmm. And you keep hearing about how there's going to be a war and everybody's getting ready, but it never happens. Well, in book two, it happens. The war starts and it doesn't stop. And all these locations that you've been introduced to in the first book, we're going to cut between them, and there's battles happening everywhere.
Well, this
it's going to be a lot. It's going to be extremely action packed. When I finished this book, I thought to myself, well, there's only like three action sequences in the whole thing. Well, that's not really true. I've gone back and reread it and go, well, you know, I kind of did work in action all throughout.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
But with this book, this second book, it's like pedal to the metal. Once it gets started, it's going to be a lot. It's going to be a lot more action. So
it's the year.
I'm excited about that. Yeah.
It's the year the Great War comes upon us all.
Yeah. Well, my blog is galengriffin.blogspot.com.
There you go.
So I'd love for everybody to visit me, find me there, and read the book, please, and let me know what you think.
As of this recording, it's in paperback on Amazon, and other places can get it too, of course. It'll be coming out, I believe, on Kindle very soon, right?
Yep.
So
yes.
There'll be that availability as well. So I guess with that, we need to wrap things up. But yeah, I can't recommend it highly enough. I think it's offbeat from the usual, but yet there's enough things that are comfortable about it that will bring in a reader who just wants a good adventure, but it's got such another level going on of both philosophical and intellectual in terms of the characters and what they're thinking and how they're being shaped, that I think it's really just an impressive book, and I can't wait to see number two. And I know other people that have read it have already said they can't wait for the next one too, so you got to get cracking on it.
I'll do my best.
All right. Thanks a lot, David. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, fam.
The Rocket's going to get on out of here for another week. Please go by www.whiterocketbooks.com. You can find David's book there. You can find my stuff there. My biggest selling books in December have been Hawk and Legion 3 Kings of Oblivion. And I just want to say real quick, I'm very, very grateful that people are reading Legion 3 Kings of Oblivion, because that's the third volume, and that probably means they've read the first two, I hope. So you'll get to this point in a couple of years, I guess, David, where you see people buying the third book and you go, oh, goody, that means people read and liked the first two. So that's a very, very good. It's always gratifying when people read book one of your series, but what's really good is when they read book three.
They decide to stick around.
Yeah, when I see people reading Metal God, I'm like, oh, man, they're all the way to seven. God bless them.
Quick shout out to my editor, Sam McDavid. Couldn't do it without him.
Way to go, Sam. You did good. All right, the Rocket's out of here, and we will see you all down the road.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.